Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This podcast is a joint presentation of the Colorado Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by Avadem Health, the makers of the TheraWorks Protect U-Pack. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast.
Welcome to the Colorado Geriatric Journal Club. October 3rd, 2019, sponsored by Vivage and in partnership with AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. My name is Travis Neal, and I'm a PA participating in post-acute care and assistant to the medical director for Vivage. Our goal with Journal Club is to promote education through quick, relevant geriatric and post-acute care specific information that you can use in your practice tomorrow. Today, we have a little potpourri of topics, quick hits of relevant post-acute info. Our topics include side effects of antidepressants by Dr. Leslie Eber, Antipsychotics in Delirium by Dr. Singh Pallett, and Candida auris by Dr. Fred Feinsod. So we're going to get started here with Dr. Singh Pallett, and she is going to talk about side effects of antidepressants.
Thanks, Travis. The article I'm going to review is called Haloperidol and Ziprasidone for the Treatment of Delirium in Critical Illness. This is an article that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine last year. It's one of those articles that made me just wonder, why are certain prescribing habits so hard to break? I mean, I was always taught in my training that if someone's crazy or they show psychotic symptoms, we give them antipsychotics. And in the intensive care, where there's so much delirium, in fact, the majority of ventilated patients have delirium, most of those patients receive antipsychotic medications despite limited data. So let me tell you about this study, and then I'll tell you why I selected it for the Journal Club. This study was done in 16 American hospitals between 2011 to 2017. And as the patients were admitted into the intensive care unit, they or their surrogates were approached to consent to enroll in the study. If the patient developed delirium and they met the criteria, they were assigned to one of three groups: placebo, haloperidol, or ziprasidone. And haloperidol, of course, is Haldol, and ziprasidone is Geodone. And the researchers, the clinicians, the patients, and their family, they were not aware of what their assignment was. So this study was randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled trial. The patients were not allowed to be in the study if they had a prolonged QT interval at baseline. They defined that as a QTC interval of over 550 milliseconds. They couldn't be in the study if they had an underlying cognitive impairment that was severe. Now, at first, as a geriatrician, I was kind of offended by that. Why don't you include the cognitive impairments patients? But I get it. I think that it would be difficult sometimes to distinguish the symptoms of dementia from delirium. And as we know from our literature, that antipsychotics are often ineffective for neuropsychiatric symptoms in dementia. So we wouldn't want to cloud that in the study. The medications were allowed to be titrated. So if they were on the placebo group, they could receive more and more placebo. If they were in the haloperidol group, they could receive IV 1.25 up to 20 milligrams per day. If they were in the ziprasidone group, they could receive up to 40 milligrams per day, IV. These are real-world ceiling doses. Every day, the people in the study were examined twice by the researchers, and they were assessed for delirium using the confusional assessment method, the CAM. If you're not familiar with that, it's described in the study pretty well. When you use the CAM tool, which is very sensitive and specific for delirium, you're looking for four things: acute change or a fluctuating course of mental status, inattention, altered level of consciousness, and disorganized thinking. If the person has both of the first two or one of the second two, they can reliably be stated to have delirium. The aim of this study was to count how many days of delirium each person had. And the hypothesis, they went into it thinking that these antipsychotics will decrease the number of days with delirium, and they were powered to detect a 2-day difference. So what happened? They had 566 patients that were randomized, and their baseline characteristics were all very similar. Well, their outcomes were also very similar. What happened was that there was no statistical difference in the number of days spent with delirium, whether the patients were in the placebo, haloperidol, or ziprasidone group. The median number of days spent with delirium was 8.5, and patients spent an average of 4 days on whatever medication or placebo they were on. There was no difference between all three groups in the 30 or 90 day survival rate, the time spent on mechanical ventilation. There was no difference in the time till discharge or the ICU readmission rates. Interestingly enough, there was also no difference in the use of opioids and other sedatives in these patients among the different groups. In terms of adverse effects, there was QT prolongation was more common in ziprasidone. There was no difference in sedation or extrapyramidal symptoms, but the authors noted that they were not powered probably to detect a difference. So why did I pick this article? How does this relate to geriatrics? So although my training was in internal medicine, that's what I did before my geriatrics fellowship, and I haven't managed an ICU patient in many years. But when I look back on my training, I was taught that antipsychotics are used for psychosis. And that nowhere is that more relevant than in a critically ill patient who has delirium. I don't believe that this article or this study has eliminated the use of antipsychotics in ICUs. I can guarantee you look across the country, every ICU in the country will have delirious patients who are taking antipsychotics. And if you look at the established body of literature showing that antipsychotics in dementia with neuropsychiatric symptoms is not effective or not very beneficial, you can see that we still, many providers still prescribe them. So why do we keep continuing to prescribe things that the evidence suggests may not really work? It brings up a lot of questions in my mind. Are we just programmed to prescribe with certain habits when it's very hard to break those habits? I think that it's very easy to say, well, other providers prescribe antipsychotics. I don't do it that much. Are our own patients always the exception to the evidence or to the black box warnings? Do we ever change the dementia diagnosis to say schizophrenia or delirium in order to justify the use of antipsychotics in behaviors with dementia? There is some evidence that this is already happening in some nursing homes, especially nursing homes that are under severe scrutiny from regulators. And when we see, maybe when we see a dementia patient who is in distress from their uncontrolled behaviors, and there it seems like there's nothing else that we can do at their home, their assisted living, or their nursing home, do we just simply turn to the medications that we know and are familiar with and use them, even though there's evidence suggesting that they may not help? So I'm going to conclude now. The authors of this study and the accompanying editorial pointed out that the mechanism of brain dysfunction in delirium is not well known. The theory that increased dopamine causes delirium should have been supported by the use of antipsychotics that decrease dopamine activity, but it wasn't. They conceived that there are structural, immunological, and network alterations and possible brain infections that can contribute to delirium. We simply don't know exactly how the brain works. So I'm asking you, the geriatricians, to keep an open mind and keep reminding ourselves, our patients, and our families and staff members that the benefits of antipsychotics in dementia and in delirium are not as great as we once thought. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Singh. That was excellent. We're going to move right on to Dr. Leslie Eber, and she's going to talk about the side effects of antidepressants.
Thanks, Travis. Thank you for having me today. So I'm going to review the article called, and the title is Adverse Effects of Pharmacological Treatment of Major Depression in Older Adults. And it was published in the Journal of American Geriatric Society in August 2019. It was a study, and the investigators, many of them had their doctors in pharmacology, and that was really a strength to the study. The objective of the study was to assess adverse effects of pharmacological antidepressants for the treatment of major depressive disorder in adults over 65 years and older. and it was a systematic review and meta-analysis. So the setting is really important in this systematic review because it included general outpatients as well as patients that were in rehab facilities and in nursing homes. So it was kind of very vast. And the interventions that they looked at, they looked in the studies using a diverse array of antidepressants that were compared with either another antidepressant or to placebo or to non-pharmacological interventions. What they measured was the adverse events, and that included arrhythmias, cognitive impairment, falls, fractures, hospitalizations, mortality, QT prolongation, serious adverse events, or withdrawal from the studies due to an adverse event. So when they looked at the results, they actually looked at 19 randomized controlled trials and 2 observational studies. And most of the studies evaluated the acute phase of treatment, which is less than 12 weeks, and with moderate severity of major depressive disorder. And what they found is the SSRIs led to statistically similar frequency of overall adverse events versus placebo with moderate strength of that data. But the SNRIs led to more overall adverse events versus placebo, and that was a high strength of evidence during the acute phase treatment. Both SSRIs and SNRIs led to more study withdrawals due to adverse events versus placebo. And specifically, duloxetine led to more falls versus placebo over actually a 24-week acute and continuation treatment. So their conclusion was that in patients 65 years and older with major depressive disorder, treatment of the acute phase with SNRIs, but not with SSRIs, was associated with statistically greater number of overall adverse events versus placebo. And again, both SSRIs and SNRIs showed a greater number of study withdrawals due to adverse events. Duloxetine was associated statistically with increased risk of falls. The few studies did head-to-head comparisons, and most of the studies were not powered to evaluate these adverse events. So this is something that they tried to stipulate via the meta-analysis, but most of the individual studies weren't made to look at this. And so if we look in the weeds of the article, there are some really interesting observations. First of all, they just mentioned that it's estimated that 50% of older patients in nursing homes struggle or report having depression. But antidepressant medications have been shown to have really a modest effect. So it's really important to consider the side effects of a medication that may not work very well in our residents. They talk about the Beers list in 2019, how SSRIs and tricyclic antidepressants are there for and talked about how they shouldn't be or considered not to be used for adults with histories of falls or fractures, and that the recommendation about bupropion as an alternative, but they also have side effects. So it's also worth noting that the study excluded patients that were exclusively enrolled for comorbid neuropsychiatric conditions or bipolar depression. Okay, so they included a whole slew of antidepressants, SSRIs, SNRIs, bupropion, mirtazapine, trazodone, and they also included tricyclic antidepressants and monoamine oxidase inhibitors as comparisons. Some of the results, and it was mentioned that a lot of these adverse events were just self-reported, so there is a bias there. And the doses of the antidepressants were reflected of the lower end of the guidelines suggested usual doses for older adults. So these aren't high doses, and that may affect the risk of adverse events. The SSRIs increased the risk of withdrawal due to adverse events during the acute phase of treatment of major depressive disorder versus placebo, but did not reach statistical significance for overall adverse events. So there are a couple of tables here that are kind of interesting. Let's see how I'm doing on time. Medium. Table 1 is all about the SSRIs, and some of the interesting things is the overall adverse events for just using an SSRI is 40 to 64%. That's pretty profound. SSRIs versus tricyclic antidepressants, what I thought was interesting here is overall for use of tricyclic antidepressants, the overall risk of an adverse event is 76%. That's, I think, also profound. And mortality associated with tricyclic antidepressants, 3.1%. Table 2 looks at the observational studies using hazard ratios, and Table 3 looks at the SNRIs. Again, they talk about dopamine having a risk of falls. Overall risk in 3 randomized controlled trials in Table 3, I thought it was notable that the risk for an adverse event for the placebo medication, 69%. So I think that we should also consider that just giving any medication, even if it's a placebo, has a significant risk of an adverse event. So when they talked about the discussion, the analysis, and they talked about the analysis was limited to detect differences in adverse events using bupropion and mirtazapine and trazodone, because they only relied on one randomized control study. So when they looked at Table 2, those are the strength of that evidence is really limited. And they also consider us to consider our other patient factors, including comorbidities and other medications that the patient is being utilized that may interact. One of the interesting things is they did a post hoc analysis showing that the odds of falling with dobutamine were greatest in those patients who also had cardiopulmonary conditions. And so these other comorbidities will increase sometimes the risk. Yeah. Oh my goodness, gosh, sorry. Duloxetine, sorry. Duloxetine, Cymbalta, sorry about that. Please forgive me. In contrast, comorbidities that were not associated in this study, in this meta-analysis with an increased risk of falling was orthostatic hypotension, gait conditions, neurological conditions, benzodiazepine use. And so in this study, that didn't increase your risk of falling. The applicability of this meta-analysis is that they excluded patients with multiple comorbidities, with other psychiatric conditions. Specifically, they excluded patients with dementia and depression. So that's a big part of our world. They also note that the pharmacokinetics in older patients changes. And one interesting thing is that they noted that in some of the studies, specifically with Lexapro versus placebo, that there was a significant difference in adverse events for patients over 75 versus patients 65 to 75. And so we may have to look at our oldest of old differently than we do for the 65 to 75 range. Finally, they just wanted to reiterate that these dosings were low dosings, that this wasn't about Cymbalta at 60 milligrams. The limitations of this study included inadequate power. None of the randomized controlled trials were designed to evaluate the adverse events. And the adverse events were also not adequately always described. So then I think I have 4 more seconds. They also had a companion editorial in the journal that was really wonderful. It was done by Dr. Lenz and Dr. Ogali from Washington University in St. Louis. And they also talk about how there's very little data to say that these medications are effective in our patients and that there's no gold standard. Many in the AGS and in many medical societies doubt the favorability of using antidepressants in our population. And they give kudos to this article for looking at the risks of antidepressants. They point that there is an optimum study that is coming along that will answer some of these other questions, and they're excited to see the data there to understand the risks of using antidepressants in our older populations. But the most interesting thing is the table on the editorial. And the table gives 7 points about how we should look about whether we should start an antidepressant in our patients. How to minimize risks and maximize benefit. They talk about that it's always a risk versus risk calculation, the risk of treating the illness versus the risk of the illness itself. So first they talk about that we should ascertain any prior treatment history of depression in our patients and use that as a guide of treating depression if we are going to treat it. If there's no history of prior treatment, we should start with an SSRI. Lexapro and sertraline have the least side effects and interactions, and you should try them first. And after 6 weeks, you should consider going up on the dosage. Use the full range of the dosage and don't just kind of quit and say it's a failure at a very low dose. You should also use a measurement tool as your guide, maybe the PHQ-9, because we all have to use that. But I also wonder if the geriatric depression scale would be useful so that it's not just subjective and when we determine whether this medication is successful in helping our patients. And they also talk about augmentation and switching if needed. So thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Eber. Appreciate that.
We will return to our interview after this brief message from Avadam, the creators of TheraWorks. What are you missing to drive better outcomes for recurrent UTI patients, from mounting antibiotic-resistant concerns to unproven over-the-counter remedies? Your options for preventing urinary tract infections in post-acute care facilities have been limited until now. Safe for a variety of urogenital uses and won't contribute to resistance, the TheraWorks Protect UPAC is the safe, clinically proven, convenient hygiene solution you've been missing. To learn more about how the UPAC can become part of your UTI prevention protocols, visit seewhatsmissing.com.
So we're going to move right on to Dr. Fred Feinsod, and he's going to discuss Candida auris, which I think is a fascinating topic. So he's going to give us a brief overview of the latest on Candida auris.
Thank you very much, Travis, and thank you, colleagues. Great presentations. I'd like to thank Dr. Lee Annenberg before I start on to my presentation, as he not only made available to us the CDC compendium on Candida auris, but also the New York Times article that came out 2 weeks ago. Candida auris is a Ascomycetes fungus, genus of course is Candida. Grows as a yeast. Now auris, A-U-R-I-S, Latin for ear, is isolated from an ear canal wound of a 70-year-old Japanese woman, female patient, that actually grew in the presence of mica fungin, which is one of the endocardins that we're going to be talking about in the second half of this brief presentation. Why is CDC concerned about Candida auris? Well, it causes serious infections. It's often resistant to medications. It's becoming more common. It's difficult to identify, and it can spread in hospitals and nursing homes. And Candida auris is one of the few Candida species that can cause invasive candidiasis. Patients at risk, extended stay patients in hospitals and nursing homes, particularly patients who are immune compromised. There's a high correlation between Candida auris infection and ESBL and CRE patients. Population had been exposed to multiple antibiotics and antifungals, Candida auris seems to mimic. Patients who have central lines are also at risk. Comorbid conditions include diabetes, sepsis, pulmonary diseases, renal diseases, and a recent surgery. Of particular interest is that Candida auris can affect all ages. It's multi-drug resistant. 90% of Candida auris is resistant to fluconazole, up to 75% voriconazoles, and about a third are resistant to amphotericin B. However, most are susceptible to echinocandins, which we will be discussing shortly. The epidemiology is fascinating. It was first discovered in 1996 in South Korea, but retrospectively, it was misidentified for more than a decade. In 2009, we mentioned the Japanese female patient who had Canada oris isolated from their ear canal. They're starting now to do whole genome sequencing, so they're able to look at DNA footprints. Interesting enough, there are a number of regions throughout the world which have experienced Candida auris systemic infection. And there seems to be a different DNA footprint between regions, but within the regions, there's great similarity. This has great implications for discussions on the use of antibiotics and antifungals in these areas with a potential for each of these regions to develop, but develop in their own way. Fascinating evolutionary concept. Looking further at the epidemiology in the United States, May 2017, there were 77 cases described, 69 from New York and New Jersey. In April 2019, there were 654 U.S. cases, 330 were from New York, 116 from New Jersey, and 170 from Illinois. Zero from Colorado. The case fatality is 1 in 3. Now the echinocardins, candins, such as caspofungin, mycofungin, and the most effective rezafungin are the medications that are used to treat this infection. These echinocandins inhibit the synthesis of beta glucan and fungal cell wall, similar to the mechanism that beta-lactams, penicillin, affects bacteria. These beta-glucans are carbohydrate polymers cross-linked with other fungal cell components that provide integrity to the fungal wall and prevent penetration of the antifungal into the cell itself. Side effects include phlebitis in the infusion vein. Each of these side effects, by the way, occur about 3% of the time. Fever, rash, nausea, and there's a potential for a histamine-like reaction similar to Redman syndrome and IV vancomycin. Flushing if infused too rapidly. And that also occurs about 3% of the time. The endocandins are large molecular weight compounds. And so there's poor penetration into the CSF, urine, and eyes. Resistance in Candida auris occur from alterations in glucan synthesis, strengthening of the fungal cell wall through increased chitin, and upregulation of stress response pathways. The advantages of the of the echinocandins is that it's a long half-life, low toxicity, does not interfere with cytochrome P450 metabolism, same dose for age and gender, more effective than amphotericin B, and there's no dose adjustment in renal failure, but there is in hepatic failure. And screening, CDC recommends scrutinizing those who are at high risk. Close healthcare contacts with patients who had experienced Candida auris, either infection or colonization. Overnight stays in a healthcare facility outside the United States, or patients with CRE infection and colonization. You swab bilateral axillae and groin for your screening tests. Of note here in Colorado, LabCorp test costs about $20 for the isolation and identification of C. auris. The yeast sensitivity, antifungal sensitivity is $6. They probably charge a bit more than that, but that is their cost. We don't routinely, the lab does not routinely speciate yeast unless it's from a blood culture. So it's important to state on the in the order that you would, that you're looking for C. auris and specifically to speciate for that particular organism. Lastly, Candida among the CDC documents that were sent to our readership, there's an excellent one, Information for Infection Preventionists. And of course, each of our long-term care facilities have a nurse dedicated and who has been educated in infection prevention, and I highly recommend that you obtain this for your IP nurses. Thank you very much. It's 1 o'clock.
1 o'clock. Thanks everyone for joining, and thanks to all of our speakers, and we'll see you next month.
Support for this broadcast is provided by Avadom Health, the creators of TheraWorks Protect. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast title. Thank you.